This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Michael Pavlich.
I've got to say, I hadn't really thought often about how towns get designed and when they were designed as well. You drive through a country town, you think, don't wonder why that's up there or that's over there, why they put a water tank on top of the hill. So it was very interesting to hear all about one of Australia's greatest ever surveyors, a fellow by the name of Townsend. Townsend of the Ranges is the name of the book. Dr. Peter Crowley is the author, and he's joining us this morning on the program. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Pav.
Hey, thanks for joining us. What an amazing fellow.
Look, absolutely. He was completely extraordinary. He worked in Australia as a surveyor and a map maker. In the 1830s and 1840s, he walked thousands of miles, sleeping out in a tent in southeastern Australia in all conditions of weather. He laid out a long list of towns, as you were mentioning before, including the town of Albury, but many, many others. And he contributed important geographical knowledge to the map of Australia. He mapped the great dividing range between the Murray and the Snowy. In 1846, he actually became the first European to locate the source of the Murray at Indi Springs. And listeners will know that that's an important point of the border between Victoria and New South Wales. And to cap it all off, he had Australia's second highest mountain named after him, Mount Townsend, on the main range of the Snowy Mountains, next door neighbour to Mount Kosciuszko, was named in honour of Thomas Scott Townsend.
I keep getting corrected that the Mount Erebus is the tallest mountain in Australia, on Australian territory, but we're talking on the mainland. So, a lot of people don't know that. You know, you say to them, what's the second tallest mountain on the Australian mainland? Everyone knows Kosciuszko. No one knows who number two is, and it's named after this fellow. I mean, that the naming of Kosciuszko is a story within itself, which we could
go into.
But a name's something which I want to talk about for a second because, I mean, you mentioned there Albury. The town of Albury. Do we know who Albury was named after?
No, we don't. And in fact, it's not completely certain. And the story of the naming of Albury is actually an interesting one that I cover in the book because Townsend was dispatched down to the crossing place on the Murray in the late 1830s to lay out a town there. But he didn't call it Albury. He used its indigenous name, which was Bungambrawatta. And that's the name that appears on all the first survey maps that he sent back to Sydney. In Sydney, someone in the government, probably the deputy Surveyor General Samuel Perry, decided that Bungambrawatta was just too long a name and wouldn't do. So the name Albury was suggested to the governor and accepted. But nobody's quite sure. It's quite difficult to pin down exactly why the name was chosen.
Who Albury was. Yeah, that's great. I love that.
Or whether it was a village in England that was, you know, of importance to somebody, I'm really not sure.
Look, there's a thing here. You mentioned that Indigenous place names were used, and this, I believe, was the preference in the early days, in the early surveying. They actually wanted and encouraged people to record the Indigenous place names because it meant there was a lack of confusion. It meant that they were more certain about certain geographical locations. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. From the 1820s when Thomas Mitchell, late 1820s when Thomas Mitchell took over as Surveyor General, the surveys were actually under instructions to record Indigenous names whenever they could. And you can understand why. I mean, they were faced with this enormous territory, new and novel geographical features. So a ready-made source of place names was actually a resource that couldn't be ignored. Now, the surveys collected them under their own terms. Thomas Mitchell wanted the names to be of a certain length and he wanted them to be spelled in particular ways. But still, the fact remains that they were under instructions to preserve Indigenous place names when they could. Now, a lot of them have disappeared beneath the surface.
Yeah.
But if you look at parish names, for example, the majority of them retain those Indigenous names that were originally recorded by the colonial surveyors.
Yeah, well, it's odd to think, you know, we have the Murrumbidgee River and we have Gundagai, yeah. which are obviously Indigenous words, and then yet we've got the Murray River and the Darling River. So it's, why did some Indigenous place names stick and others didn't?
Oh, look, it's difficult. I think just the vagaries of how exploration unfolded has a lot to do with it. I think it came down a lot to chance. The first, the Murrumbidgee was obviously discovered, located by Europeans before the Murray was, and an Indigenous name was applied, and that name stuck. When a man named Charles Sturt went down the Murray in the early 1830s, in the early months of 1830s, on encountering the river, named it after a very big fish in the English aristocracy, George Murray, who was a politician at the time, and didn't record an Indigenous name for the river at all. Prior to that, it had actually been given another European name by the explorer Hamilton Hume, who encountered the river in the 1820s and named it after his family. So for a long time, the Murray had two European names, the Hume and the Murray. But
Was there a directive at some point to keep the Indigenous names that sounded good? Or that were easy to speak or easy to say?
Yeah. It seems that it came down to that in certain cases, and I think that explains the fate of Bungambrawatta, the true name of Albury. It was just too long. I can't think off the top of my head. It was either nine letters was the limit on how long Indigenous names recorded by the surveyors were allowed to be, and how they were allowed to use diphthongs. And, Thomas Mitchell tried to discourage complicated spelling. So they were modified in the course of being reported.
Look, I'm interested to talk about the actual job of surveying, and we'll do that in just a second. But Bruce has called from Double Bay. If you want to join this conversation, 1300 800 222 is the number to call. 1300 800 222. G'day, Bruce.
Hi. Now, Count Strzelecki, a Polish guy.
Strzelecki, Polish explorer. Yep.
He named the highest mountain in Australia be Mount Kosciuszko, but I believe it was Townsend because he went past there first using an aeroid barometer. There's a good chance Townsend is only a couple of metres in it all.
Yeah, Peter looks at this in his book, and not only that, Peter, you suggest that there might have even been mountain men up there even before Strzelecki set eyes upon on Kosciuszko.
Well, I mean, absolutely. The first European known to have set foot on the main range was actually a bushman, an amateur surveyor called Stuart Ryrie, who climbed onto Ram's Head in the just a few months before Strzelecki arrived on the main range. But we don't think he got to the summit of Mount Kosciuszko. I had to face the issue of who was the first European to stand on the summit of Kosciuszko in the book because, you know, I was writing a biography about Townsend. Mm. But I also want people to understand that, you know, the Monero region, the Snowy Mountains, had squatters in it for, a decade and a half, and it's probably likely that some of them actually climbed major peaks out of curiosity. But also, of course, Indigenous Australians used the mountains for thousands of years, and it is vanishingly unlikely that an Indigenous person was not the first to climb, Mount Kosciuszko. Of course they must have. So I think that just puts it in a proper perspective.
Bruce?
The New Zealanders are very naughty. They call our Mount Kosciuszko a paddock with its back up, while Townsend looks like a proper mountain with great clumps of, peaks and rock on the top. I've been there in winter on skis all through there.
Right.
And it'd be much nicer on a postage stamp or something to have a higher mountain looking a bit more like a mountain.
Look, Bruce, you mentioned too there about the controversy about which is actually higher. You look at that in your book as well, Peter, don't you?
Not so much which is higher. Just, I mean, Mount Kosciuszko is certainly higher than Mount Townsend. But as Bruce says, there's not much in it. I mean, it's the length of a cricket pitch. It's, you know, about 20 metres or something, something like that. The controversy is when Strzelecki climbed the main range from the west in 1840, there's been a debate since the early days about whether he was standing, when he claimed to have reached the highest point, said, this is where it is, this is the highest point, where was he standing? Was he on top of Mount Townsend, Mount Townsend, or was he on top of Kosciuszko? That's the debate. And, you know, like all people, that issue has been debated around campfires and in learned journals for a long, long time.
You got a theory, Bruce?
Oh, I wonder what the measurements are in, you know, modern GPS measurement. Look, the other one I wanted to talk about was what happened around the Jervis Bay area. Wasn't that considered first for Canberra? But they were worried about naval shelling and they moved it inland. You heard the tale?
Do you know anything about that, Peter?
No, I don't, Bruce. Sorry, I think that's slightly out of Townsend territory, so unfortunately I don't.
I mean, obviously they did choose Jervis Bay as a military settlement or a naval settlement, and they chose that, I think, because of its location to Canberra. But certainly there was a big debate about where they were going to locate Canberra. I think it was Cooma was one of the possible locations where they were thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting counterfactual to think about just how the country would be different if a different place had been. Like, I think I have a memory, don't quote me on this, that the town of Delegate on southern Monero was considered as a possible location for a town.
I think you're right about that.
And that's, I mean, if that had become the national capital, we'd probably have, you know, super highways over the mountains between Gippsland and Monero. It would have shaped the southeast quite differently, I would have thought. Just an interesting.
Indeed. We'll talk to David just quickly. Hello, David.
I'm just wondering, could Albury have been named after Prince Albert, the husband of Queen Victoria? Albert Albury? Instead of calling it Albert Town, it could have been called Albury because of ALB, Albert.
Very possible, David, I think, because there is a Port Albert around the place, but possibly Prince Albert he would have been around. I know he would have been later, Prince Albert, wouldn't he? Do you know anything about that, Peter?
He would have been later, absolutely, yeah. I don't think that's a really good suggestion. You know, Alberton down in Port Albert obviously is named after the Prince Consort. I'm not sure that that Albury was, so I think, well, I don't know. The local people would probably give you their views on it. The idea that I have in mind that I can't prove in a source is that it was named after a village in England that was significant to some party in government. Yeah, whoever, but I'm not sure.
Whoever was in the office on that particular day. We'll head back to the phones in a second. I need to ask you about this, though, because how the hell did they do it? How did they get all of these distances and measurements and do it so accurately in such hard terrain? I mean, obviously a pretty tough gig, but tell us what a Gunter's chain is.
Okay. So a Gunter's chain was a chain of standard length, at least it was supposed to be, 66 feet long, I think, from memory, and it was stretched out from point to point in Townsend's days by convicts known as chain men, and that's how they measured distance. And so at the end of every chain or set of chains, they would take bearings, particularly if the direction of the chain was change. Now, I point out in the book, I'm absolutely not a surveyor. I'm just an amateur who was just enthralled by this process. And it was just using these simple tools of a chain of fixed length and various forms of compass that they drew the first maps of southern Australia, of all our rivers and ranges, the first accurate maps And it's just an incredible feat. You know, they recorded their data in field books, and then they retired to freezing cold tents in the middle of nowhere and turned their data into these absolutely extraordinary maps. And that's they formed the basic archaeology of, you know, Australian maps. If you take any map of the southeast, say of the Snowy Mountains, and you keep drilling down through successive older generations of maps, the person you eventually hit is Townsend. He was the man who drew the first accurate maps. I mean, plenty of people drew maps in the early days, but they weren't particularly accurate.
And he was fairly highly regarded by his superiors for his work, and, you know, climbed up through the ranks pretty quickly to become a high up person in the surveying department. I just just going back to the chain thing. So this is a 60 foot lump of chain, and they had to drag that around with them everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they got around the countryside in using very cumbersome equipment. They often threw the chain and all their other equipment, if they could, their tents in the back of bullock drays. And that, of course, slowed them down. And one of the things that's very distinctive about Townsend is that that whole process was just too slow for him. You know, he found that he couldn't get beasts of burden, horses, bullock drays into the most remote and rugged country,
surprise,
which is still quite inaccessible. So he took to sleeping out in the open without tents, and his men just carried their supplies on their backs. And, yeah, they did drag this chain along. So the Snowy River, the lower Snowy River around the Black Allen line, that straight line section of the border between Victoria and Tasmania, was actually surveyed in just that way, with Townsend sleeping out in the open, taking enormous risks. I mean, you can imagine the exposure. And, you know, men in his party did die. It was in that way that he drew the first maps of, you know, some of the most iconic country in the southeast.
Don would say a cricket pitch is 22 yards long, so obviously this is the imperial measurements they're using here. But so, so to measure the distance, say, from, you know, Goulburn to Albury, for example, he had to, they basically staked out a chain all the way every 60, every 60 feet.
From point to point.
Absolutely.
That is absolutely how they did it. So it was, a single chain was 66 feet long and had 100 links. And a length of 80 chains was equal to a mile. Sorry, we're in imperial here, so going back to Townsend units. And they could specify distances in terms of the, you know, number of chains they spanned, or even the number of links. So, for example, when Townsend was ordered to Melbourne in 1839 to relieve Robert Hoddle as the surveyor in charge, and one of the tasks that was on his list as he went south was to chain the road between Yass and Gundagai. So that we'll all be familiar with that stretch of road on the Hume.
Yep.
Townsend's route was basically the same. That beautiful drive between Gundagai and Yass. So Townsend was the first to actually measure it out and plot it out and draw a map of it. And he did it with a chain stretched from point to point and a compass. Absolutely remarkable.
You mentioned Gundagai there. One thing about that, my understanding is that the initial town or settlement of Gundagai was in the wrong place. It was very prone to flooding, and Townsend came along and said, we've got to move it.
Yeah, well, it's a really, really interesting and somewhat infamous story. The town of Gundagai, the original town, was put on a floodplain, a very dangerous place to locate it.
And anybody who's been near there, you know the floodplain. There's a massive bridge that goes across it.
And, you know, the local Indigenous people, the Wiradjuri people, warned them. They soon learnt the lessons about, you know, that obviously repeated flooding at that site was a major risk. When the town was actually laid out there in the late 1830s by surveyors called Butler and Stapleton, strangely enough, there was no report on the town submitted with the map that went to the governor. So no report that sort of brought to the attention of authorities, not that it really needed to be pointed out that this was a flood-prone site. And shortly afterwards, Townsend arrived on his way down to Melbourne after having surveyed that road between Yass and Gundagai. And he wrote a letter that vividly described how, even when the town wasn't flooded, when he took his bullocks across it at a ford just next to the town, you know, when the town was dry, they were washed 100 metres downstream by the force of the current. So he sort of gently suggested that that the town, that it may not have been the most ideal place for a crossing place of a road, but you know, by the time he came, you know, there was the, you know, the embryo of a town was there. There was a tavern, there were buildings. So Sydney was wedded to the idea that that would be the place where the road between Sydney and Melbourne, the Port Phillip Road, crossed the Murrumbidgee. It only does so once, and they were keen that it happened at Gundagai. Now, of course, during the next decade, during the 1840s, the town flooded on a regular basis. But then, in the early 1850s, the worst, the most lethal flood in Australian history took place at Gundagai. In the passage of a single night, the waters rose and the whole town was wiped away, and hundreds of people died. Mm. So
this is one of the great, or perhaps the greatest loss of life from a flood in Australian history, I think. And you mentioned the Wurundjeri there; they actually saved a lot of the colonials in that particular flood, didn't they?
Oh, they did. I mean, the Wurundjeri were incredibly skilled at rapidly improvising canoes from bark, and that night in the darkness, in an act of extraordinary heroism, Aboriginal men led by a man named Jackie got into their bark canoes and were plucking survivors off rooftops, and the loss of life would have been much more had it not been for them. In fact, if you go into the main street of Gundagai these days, there's actually a statue there that memorialises Jackie's incredible rescue attempts.
We've heard that story before. It's incredible, and it should be generally pointed out that some of the surveyors and the parties did run into trouble with some of the Indigenous tribes, but generally speaking, they were given safe passage and helped by a lot of the Indigenous people that they encountered or came across.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, if we, you know, start with the Surveyor General, Thomas Mitchell, he used Aboriginal guides in his parties. You know, his record on the frontier was tarnished, unfortunately, by some acts of violence carried out by his men on the Murray. But he did appreciate the significance or the importance of having Aboriginal people in his party. And it's to be expected, although they tend not to record this information in official letters, the surveyors must have also taken advantage of Indigenous knowledge. And my impression is very much that the Indigenous people were you know, helped to keep them safe on country, as well as providing them with essential navigational information.
It's sort of heartbreaking in a way, because basically their land was being taken away from them. This was absolutely part of the process that started that. So just goes to show what a wonderful welcoming people most of the Indigenous tribes were to colonials, and how much they helped us settle this country. Anne-Marie, g'day.
Oh, hi, Pav. I was just wondering, if we think it's too hard to pronounce some Indigenous names, why do we then go to, like, Sir Thomas Mitchell? No, I'm serious.
No, fair enough.
Like, it's kind of like we're looking through this thing as a Western lens, and we say, oh, the Indigenous people were good, you know, they helped us. You know, I just find it fascinating how we still think that we're still looking through things as Westerners and colonisers, and why can't we change names back to, like, I live in Dandenong, and apparently it's Tanyelong, which means lofty mountains. It's not that hard.
Yeah, really. These names, though, stick in people's heads. I know an effort has been made to rename a number of locations, and some of them rightly so because they're named after scoundrels. But, I mean, Kosciuszko is an interesting one because, I mean, for a start, we're not even pronouncing it properly. Apparently it's Kosciuszko or something. But, I mean, it'd be much easier for us to pronounce an indigenous name of the original name of Mount Kosciuszko.
I think that's a point that's really well made. Sorry, I missed the name of the caller. Beg your
Anne-Marie,
pardon.
Anne-Marie,
I agree with you completely. And I'm an advocate for dual naming of landscape in consultation with indigenous elders. I completely support that.
Anyway, we run out of time. It's a fascinating book. I must say I really enjoyed reading it, and it was someone I didn't know anything about, so it was lovely to read about Townsend. The book is called Townsend of the Ranges. Peter Crowley is the author. Peter, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Pav. Thanks for your interest. I really appreciate it.